Well, Lasso, this morning we will return to settling the mind in its natural state, but I thought it might be of interest also to share with you a bit of a correspondence I had over the weekend. I've been aware for a couple of years now of a fascinating account, which I won't give the whole story of, but it was a woman whose name is Pam Reynolds, who had an almost 8-hour surgery on her brain for an aneurysm deep inside the brain, in which they basically killed her. They cooled the brain down, they drained all the blood from the brain, her heart stopped, everything stopped, brain was flatlined, and there was no blood in it. And then while she was during this operation, she had an out-of-body experience, and she made accurate observations of a number of events in the operating room, recognizing the pitch of the drill that was used, recognizing and reporting later conversations, parts of conversations, and other things seen. This was when there was absolutely no activity in her visual cortex, and her eyes were blocked. And so that it's a fascinating story, one of the most compelling out-of-body experiences, scientifically reported, took place in a neurological facility. But I really got to wondering, it comes bothering me, there were no photons coming in, striking the retina, no activity of visual cortex. How could she see colors? How could she hear sounds and make sense of sounds when the auditory cortex, the frontal cortex, the visual cortex, all of these were absolutely shut down? And so I wrote to a world expert named Bruce Grayson, who is at the University of Virginia, and he really is probably the top person, or at least among the top people in the whole world in this field. I can't say he's the top, but he's very, very distinguished. And he wrote back, I guess it was yesterday morning, and he cited an even more interesting case by a man who's now retired, but he was the foremost researcher named Kenneth Ring, I believe at the University of Connecticut, doing just very rigorous studies of out-of-body and near-death experiences. And Kenneth Ring had found a number of cases of people who were born blind, had a near-death experience, out-of-body experience, and gave accurate reports of seeing what was taking place in their environment when they were born blind. And so it creates a great koan, kind of a mystery. How is it possible to see colors, see shapes, and so forth, hear sounds, when there are no sound waves coming in and no cortices that are there to process it? And the short answer, of course, we have no snappy answer, that makes perfectly good sense. But it is, I think, the responsibility of a scientist to look clearly at the empirical evidence, and this is very clear evidence, and try to make sense of it. And so Bruce Grayson's response was, in some mysterious way, he says, it seems that when the mind is operating in this coarse manner, and he was actually using Buddhist terminology without knowing it, because I don't think he's versed in Buddhism at all, but the coarse mind, then what in fact the brain does is the brain constricts the functioning of the subtle consciousness. And as long as it's constricted, then it's dependent on visual cortex, photons, light waves, sound waves, and so forth and so on. But it's constricted. In fact, so in one way, same coin, two sides. In the one way, the brain enables and conditions the functioning of the coarse mind, including the five physical senses. So that's a positive thing. The same coin, the brain is a limiting factor, limiting the function of the subtle mind. So it enables the coarse but limits the subtle. And when the coarse is shut down, then the subtle is able to manifest much more freely without the constraints or the requirements of photons, light, sound waves, and so forth from the physical environment and from the brain. So this is relevant to our practice here, and we're going to start in about a minute or two. But as we settle the mind in its natural state, we are, in fact, seeing with the mind. We're seeing with the mind. The eyes are disengaged from what we're actually attending to. And seeing with the mind, we are clearly, on occasion, seeing colors. Colors, as we do during a dream, we see colors. And so, in this similar alley, you can visualize a red watermelon with a green rind. And there it is. And so we are seeing colors, we can hear sounds and so forth. In fact, as you attend to the mind, you may also experience tastes, smells, all kinds of tactile sensations and so forth. And so we attend to these without distraction, without grasping. And in the process of settling the mind and in that its natural state, then this mental consciousness, yikinabajeva, then gradually melts into the substrate consciousness, and the dharmadhatu, or the domain of the mind, then dissolves into the substrate. A number of you are taking this as your main practice and commenting in your one-on-one meetings with me that, oh, there seems to be still an awful lot of stuff. How can I get it to slow down? There's still a lot of stuff arising in the mind. And an essential feature of this practice is don't try to make it calm down. This is a matter of settling the mind in its natural state. And so it's much more a matter of discovering jhamata as you allow the contents, the hurry and flurry of the mind gradually to subside in its own way. It's not just forcing it down, it's allowing this ball of yarn of the mind to unravel of its own accord in its own way and dissolve into the substrate and the substrate consciousness. But really the theme that the Beatles picked up on from the practice of settling the mind is natural state. Let it be. Okay, good. Let's jump in. Let's do it again. Settle your body in its natural state and your respiration in its natural rhythm. And for a little while, take as the object of mindfulness the space of the body and the tactile sensations that arise within that space, and attend to them without distraction and without grasping. In the felt, let there be just the felt. And if we should give words to it, these would simply be tactile events arising from the space of the body and dissolving back into the space of the body with no owner, with no personal identity. They are simply events arising from and emerging from and dissolving back into space. And now let your eyes be open. Open but vacant, as if you were daydreaming, lost in thought. Whereas in fact you are clearly, luminously directing the full force of your attention to this space of phenomena, it's called Dharmadhatu, this relative Dharmadhatu, the space of phenomena that appear to mental consciousness, the space of the mind. We attend to the space of the mind and whatever mental events arise within that domain. Not analyzing them, not following them, not wishing they would go away or quiet down, but simply being present with them and observing their nature from moment to moment, always fresh. Once again, if we liken the mind to a stage on which players come and go, for the remainder of this session, let's focus, like focusing a camera lens, or focusing our eyes. Let's focus our mental consciousness on the actors that come and go on the stage of the mind. Most particularly, the thoughts and the images. Observe their nature without distraction and without grasping. how do you know whether you're actually doing this practice or whether you're simply daydreaming? And it's a matter of motion versus stillness. If you have a sense of your mind, your awareness, moving, your attention moving here, moving there, being carried away by thoughts off to the reference of the thoughts, this is daydreaming. It's simply distraction. But when doing this practice correctly, there's a stillness like space of your own awareness, called in Tibetan Negyu Zongjuk. It is the fusion of stillness and motion. Your awareness resting in stillness while the activities of the mind, the players on the stage of the mind, come and go. The key here is deep relaxation, a looseness, so that you are not snagged by the thoughts and images that arise in the space of the mind. even in the early phases of shamatha practice, it's not too early to utilize and refine your faculty of introspection, by which you monitor the flow of attention. And the one job of this faculty for such practice is to detect the occurrence of excitation or laxity as swiftly as possible, so that you do not simply develop bad habits or waste time. So be on guard. This is the sentry for your practice, the watchman. As soon as you see that the mind has been carried away, loosen up, relax, and return to the immediate present, and whatever right now is arising in the space of the mind. And note, as soon as laxity arises, there's a dullness, a lack of clarity. Recognize this and immediately arouse your attention. Focus clearly as you take a fresh interest in your own mind. And let's continue practicing now in silence. And let's bring this session to a close. So this practice of shamatha is clearly one of polishing the lenses of the telescope of the mind. And this notion of slipping from the coarse mind to the subtle mind and then having an expanded vision, this is manifest in these out-of-body or near-death experiences. Also in what scientists call remote viewing, or in Buddhism, one of the five types of munshe, of remote viewing or clairvoyance, seeing things that are very far away. Once again, you're seeing things very far away, so there's no chance of photons getting to you, and you're seeing colors and shapes. So it must be operating out of some deeper dimension of reality that you're making that access. And Atisha says that the robust platform, I'm paraphrasing him, but the robust platform for developing these modes of paranormal seeing, remote viewing, remote hearing, clairaudience, is shamatha. Achieve shamatha, and he said you can develop these. And what happens with shamatha is you gain access to the form realm, and you gain access, your operating base now is subtle mind rather than coarse mind. So as long as modern science confines itself to the study of brain and study of coarse mind or psyche, then they'll simply reinforce the notion that the mind is simply an emergent property of the brain, because there's no evidence to the contrary, as long as you're just looking there. But if you let the bottom drop out and look into these anomalous experiences of near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, and reports of past life, and then really start probing into subtle consciousness, then one sees that the coarse mind and the brain are like the thin crust on the surface. And with the underlying, if one is going to use the word underlying, it's not underlying brain mechanisms, it's underlying substrate consciousness. That's underlying. This also has shed some light on the fact that in the bardo, following death prior to the next rebirth, people in the bardo also, individuals, bardo beings, also see directly. They hear things, they understand what is being said. But no eyeballs, no brain. So operating out of a subtle level. So in short, I think this practice of shamatha, accessing this whole other dimension of consciousness, is really can serve as a catalyst for a true revolution in the mind sciences. Because it's meeting head-on the assumptions, the materialistic assumptions that underlie virtually all of the mind sciences. Shamatha can be a catalyst for revolution in the mind sciences. When we go deeper down to vipassana, down to dzogchen, stage of completion, mahamudra, then that's beyond science. Science as we know it. But that, if that were really revitalized, if this were really brought to its strength, then that could bring about a true contemplative renaissance. So a scientific revolution and a contemplative renaissance. I would say that's the mission statement for the Mind Center and the Observatory. And that contemplative renaissance, of course, would not be confined, I would hope it would not be confined to Buddhism alone. But let the Christians rediscover the tremendous depths of their own tradition and for all the other great contemplative traditions as well. So, have a good morning. I'll see you this afternoon.